We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be revisiting the battle over net neutrality, something that we have talked about before on this program. Now, if you're not sure what that means, the concept really is pretty simple. That's this. When you're surfing the web, the idea is that you should have equal access to all websites on an equal basis. Now, not all internet service providers see it that way. What they would like to be able to do, some of them at least, would like to be able to charge the content providers for faster access. And some people worry that, in effect, what that would do is to create a two-tiered internet with a fast lane and a slow lane, one that would be essentially a private internet and one that would be a public internet. We'll talk about recent developments in the area of net neutrality in this part of Focus 580 with Matthew Wood. He is the Associate Director of the Media Access Project. He is an attorney by his training and experience. He joined the project in the fall of 2009. Before that, he was an associate in the communications practice groups of two other law firms in Washington, D.C., and then he went to work for Media Access Project. It is a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization that works in communications policy and, among other things, was really one of the first organizations to really advocate for open access and network neutrality. He's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We just ask people to please be on the topic, make it a question, be as brief as you can. That will help us get in as many different callers as possible. We like to keep things moving along. Questions certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have email. You can send along your comments that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mr. Wood, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and how are you?
I'm very well.
Good, good.
A little hot here, as you can imagine.
Well, it's that time of year, isn't it?
It is. That's what we don't get that here in D.C. We don't know what to do.
All right. Well, I appreciate you spending some time with us, certainly. And, you know, as I said, this is a subject that from time to time has come up on programs, but at the same time, I feel that every time we do it, we probably need to start right at the beginning and say, well, what is it that we're talking about here? In the simplest possible terms, what is net neutrality?
Sure. Well, your introduction was perfectly fine. It's probably even a little bit narrower than that. The idea that all traffic should move across the Internet on an equal basis is a very good shorthand and very basic way to say it. It's narrower than that, I say, because it's really not a claim that everything must be equal, literally. If a provider has to prioritize certain traffic for emergency purposes, calls to 911 should go in front of downloading video at home, for instance. Nobody has a problem with that, although there are some questions about how to technologically do that. There's also the concept that, as there has been in phone service for the past century, more or less, you know, some kinds of discrimination are not unreasonable. There are a lot of claims that net neutrality proponents want everything to be free online, or that the government will step in and control it, or that people will not be allowed to pay lower prices. Everybody has to pay the same amount. Really, all those things are outside the pale, and we can talk about some of those, but I just want to put out at the beginning that a lot of those are kind of red herrings. Mm-hmm. The way you phrased it is really the basic way, although it is limited in a few ways beyond that. You know, for instance, the principles that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, here in Washington put forward in 2005 made very clear that that only applied to lawful content. So something like copyright violations or other unlawful material, not just something that's being unlawfully transmitted, but something that is actually breaking the law, various unsavory things like that, would not be covered by net neutrality. It's not any sort of claim that, you know, the Internet is above the law in some strange way. And there are lots of questions about how to implement these kinds of regulations and rules, but the basic idea is that, as you said, things move across the Internet equally without there being additional toll lanes or toll booths or discrimination by the people who own the wires and who own the spectrum over which that information comes to you.
Right. And as you say, organizations like yours and people like you're not saying that some kind of traffic management isn't warranted But I think that though the company, the internet service provider, some of the things that they're talking about, that's what they're labeling it as. They're saying, oh, well, this is just traffic management. And I think that the concern is that some of the proposals that have been made, for example, we'll get into talking about this most recent kind of proposal that was floated by Google and Verizon. I think some people would say, well, we're going beyond simple traffic management here.
That the network providers are going beyond,
yeah,
or that the government is going beyond?
That the network providers are, what they're talking about doing is going beyond simple traffic management.
Right, and it's a difficult concept. I mean, obviously there's a lot of wiggle room, and lawyers love that kind of stuff because then we get to play around the edges at it. But when we talk about network management, what we say is it should be reasonable network management or something that is legitimately required to manage the traffic on the Internet to make sure everybody has a good enough experience that the congestion does not bring down certain neighborhoods or certain networks. And so if there's a valid technical basis for managing the network, then, again, that's something that network providers should be able to do and do today to a certain extent. The kind of thing that we're talking about preventing is what I would call economic prioritization, monetizing content or monetizing channels, charging more, not based on how much of the pipe you're using, mm-hmm. how much bandwidth you're using, but based on who you are. You know, Google has big pockets. Let's make them pay more to get their data to our customers. And so that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, not allowing the bleeding over of reasonable or required technical management to become something that is another cash register for people who can control the wires and can become a choke point and serve as a gatekeeper to that information that today more or less flows freely across the Internet without any sort of differentiation or prioritization.
Yeah, and that's, I think that gets us an interesting point, and we might end up talking about this some more, but just to pick on it just up for a second here, I think that right now what people are saying is people who are arguing for what seems to be non-neutrality, it seems that at this point, what it's all about is money. Basically, that's what it's all about is money. And how much can a service, an internet service provider, charge a content provider for carrying their content? But some people do worry, though, that bound up in all of this is the possibility of controlling content for its content. And that's something that they worry about, too. That is, an internet service provider looking at a particular kind of content and saying, well, you know, I don't think I really agree with that. And for that reason, I'm not going to pass it through my pipeline.
Right. I mean, you make several great points there and interesting points, and I'll just touch on a couple of them. On the economic side, you know, again, I think there's lots of red herrings and lots of disinformation in this issue, either purposefully or not. Net neutrality proponents are not saying capitalism is bad and network operators don't deserve to make a profit or anything even close to that, although sometimes we're caricatured as that. There are legitimate questions about how to monetize content, how these operators can make the revenues they need to extend service and to provide broadband service to people who don't have it today. And we can talk about those economic issues, but I think at base our position is that, yes, you know, monetizing content to some degree is fine, but not in the ways that they're looking to do or proposing they might do in the future, which is to, as you said, charge content providers additional amounts. It could go the other way, too. It could be charging consumers additional amounts, something that we've thrown around a term, cablization, which is a made-up word, but one that I think is pretty understandable to people who have paid cable bills. You pay extra for certain channels and for certain tiers. And so this non-neutral network that is divided based on what your content is rather than just simply how much bandwidth it takes up could take the form of charging not only the content providers who are sending that to you, but also potentially could take the form of charging you more to receive certain content or to access certain websites. When it comes to the censorship angle, I think, not to put too fine a point on it, but to jump to your second point, obviously only the government can be guilty of censorship in the traditional way that we understand here with the First Amendment protecting us against such things. However, you know, these large network operators who receive all sorts of government privileges in terms of rights of way and protection from competition in some other ways, you know, they're not government actors, but they are serving a very public function. And so as you point out, if one of them decides they don't like something that's passing across that network of theirs, regardless of whether or not they're making money off of it, if it's just simply a political motivation, you know, you oftentimes hear people who are opposed to these kinds of government regulations saying, that's never going to happen. Why would a network operator have any reason to do that? It might be for a very benign reason. It might be for something that is sort of somewhere between political and economic motivations, not to get outside of our country because there's lots to talk about here. But if you look north to Canada, back in 2005, one of the ISPs there did block some of its own union's websites during a very contentious labor dispute. So you have that kind of, you know, that's somewhat economic, but also a very political and sensitive area, and one where we'd like to see free expression preserved and not give network operators the rights to block off the messages of people who they might disagree with. Something else, just to throw one more piece in here, is text messaging. Not the Internet, but something that, like the Internet in this country for the last 5 or 10 years, has been in kind of a regulatory limbo where the FCC is not sure how to treat it. And Verizon back in 2007 blocked messages from NARAL, which is obviously a sort of Planned Parenthood, pro-choice kind of organization. Raises the hackles of some more than others, perhaps, but not only NARAL, but also people on the other side of that very issue jumped up and said, wait a minute, we don't want the network operators to deciding that, you know, certain content should not go through because it's, quote, unsavory or less desirable or might be objectionable to people. That's not the kind of role we want the government playing. It's also not the kind of role we want Verizon or Comcast or AT&T playing. At least that's the way most people have seemed to think about it. So that censorship idea, it's a little bit trickier than something where the government would be stepping in, but obviously these companies control a lot of what flows over the Internet in this country, and having them have the ability to turn that spigot off whenever they'd like is something that gives us pause.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Matthew Wood. He is Associate Director of the Media Access Project. It's a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization that works in communications policy. It's based in Washington. We're talking this morning about net neutrality. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. This is something, the last time we talked about it, I think, was back in May, and the reason that we wanted to revisit the subject just here recently was because of some stories, and I'm sure people have perhaps read about this, particularly if they're interested in these issues. This was a proposal that has just recently been floated by Google and Verizon. And the reason I think perhaps it got a lot of people's attention was that in the past, the folks at Google had been pretty much, at least they talked very positively about net neutrality. But here Google and Verizon came along and said, well, okay, as far as wired connections go, yes, good, net neutrality, good. Let's enforce those rules. But in what everybody knows is a burgeoning area of access, wireless, they said, well, now here, we got a problem with the idea of net neutrality. We think, again, because there's so much traffic now, going to be so much more, people with their smartphones and their iPads and so forth, that we actually need to do a little bit more management here. And they also suggested something that you suggested, that, you know, well, why not, what would be wrong with us creating some kind of special line of service and perhaps charging more for particular kinds of access? Why did this story grab and concern people so much, people who are already concerned with this whole net neutrality debate?
Right. So you mentioned that Google had been, and I think still remains, an open Internet proponent or a net neutrality proponent, although this proposal did make some people question that. I'll try to stay away from guessing about motivations, because who can really say, but you really can't avoid it in some respects. I'm trying to think about why companies change their positions over time. The reason it upset so many people who had been fighting with Google for net neutrality protections and other sorts of reforms that are linked to that are the exact last two reasons that you mentioned, the wireless exemption and what are called managed or specialized services, which in theory could be relatively benign or could be an exemption that really swallows the rule and that allows for the Internet to be more or less frozen in place or even diminished over time as these privatized networks or additional pay networks take over and people can only get certain content from there. If you want to get ESPN, for example, you're a big sports fan, you get it on the private network, it's higher quality, but it's also a lot more expensive than it is today to simply pay a flat fee for your monthly broadband connection and go to whatever website you wish, whether it's a very large corporate website or a small one that's run by your neighbor. Those are really the two main problems that people had with it, the wireless exemption and saying that wireless is different and therefore shouldn't be regulated at all, more or less, and the managed services bucket. Another thing that concerned especially legal advocates here who work on communications law issues, people that I work with, were portions of that Google Verizon proposal that suggested the FCC not have any rulemaking authority and more or less retreat into the background here and only adjudicate things on a case-by-case basis. So if you can complain about something going wrong, somebody blocking your service, your Internet service provider doesn't allow you to access certain websites or slows down their traffic terribly, behaves in some sort of anti-competitive way potentially, you could go to the FCC to complain about that, but the commission would have no rulemaking authority to establish the ground rules on which you would make that complaint. So it would really have taken the FCC, which for the last 70 years or more has been a public interest protection agency, doesn't have exactly the same kinds of mandates that something like an antitrust regulator has, where it's based on a showing of actual harm to consumers. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission here in Washington, has been authorized to and has made rules in the public interest, and obviously that's a hard thing to define. But it just means that they have a broader mandate to ensure that network neutrality or some sort of non-discrimination principle is the rule, that freedom of expression is prioritized online, not expression from people who pay an extra amount to the network operator. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things that the FCC has done historically, and those are the kinds of things that the Google-Verizon legislative proposal kind of puts the FCC out of business for going forward. A lot of people thought, and the initial stories about the Google-Verizon deal were that they'd made some sort of business arrangement between the two companies for Google to do the kinds of things that this framework might allow, to have a fast lane service on the wired internet, or to somehow make some sort of special deal on wireless content. And they came out and they said, no, that's not the case. This isn't a deal. This is a policy proposal. This is a legislative framework. I think they thought that that would get them off the hook somewhat. Really, I think that actually turned the temperature up. People kind of looked at that and said, well, wait a minute. That's the FCC's job, or that's Congress's job. Google and Verizon are, of course, stakeholders and large ones and have a role to play and a public voice in these issues. But the idea that they weren't simply making a deal for themselves, but instead were proposing something that would basically govern the entire internet is something that I think set off a lot of alarm bells for advocates and people who maybe weren't paying attention before that. There's one advocate here in D.C. named Mark Cooper, a longtime consumer rights champion who's at the Consumer Federation of America, and he has pointed this out recently. For many years, network neutrality opponents have said it's a solution in search of a problem. You know, this isn't happening now. There's nothing being blocked. What are you guys worried about? And what Mark Cooper has said is Google and Verizon were nice enough to come out and show us what the problem is, that we could have this kind of loophole that's larger than the actual internet itself, and we could have wireless access, which is probably the future of internet access, especially for large portions of the country, demographically speaking and geographically speaking. If those things are completely taken off the table, then are the protections that we have on the wired side in the Google Verizon framework really worth very much? And our answer would be no.
Hmm. Is it thought that, and maybe it's as if almost a foolish question, but is it thought that for provider internet service providers like Verizon or AT&T or Comcast, and maybe also for companies like Google, that if they could do what we're talking about, that is either charge content providers for a better, faster pass-along of content, or invent kind of premium services that would be like the internet but better, for which you would pay more money. Is it thought that for companies like that, there's the potential to make a lot of money doing this?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really what they're after when it comes to the specialized services category and also the wireless exemption. For us, there's really just one internet. You know, to think of something as the mobile internet is relatively old-fashioned. And, of course, I say that knowing that a couple years ago that would have been a very valid and defensible position. But things change very quickly with the smartphones out there. And it's not that everybody has an iPhone or a Droid or something like that these days. Mm-hmm. But more and more people do. And there really is more or less one internet now. The mobile exemption, again, we're not saying that there are no differences between wireless and wired networks. There very well may be, and I'll go so far as to say there are technical differences between them, but we think the same principles should apply to both, not that there should be a different set of principles for wired and wireless. One set of principles that governs both, net neutrality, the rule for both, with different reasonable network management practices allowed on either of those networks, depending on what is necessary to manage the congestion. The thought about whether or not there's a lot of money to be made here, again, we look at the cable model, and it was kind of comical. The only example on the conference call that Verizon and Google had when they announced this that the CEO of Verizon could come up with was a 3D opera channel, which might sound great to people listening right now, but, you know, wouldn't be a mass market service, let's say, for a lot of the country. Something like that, you might look at that and say, why couldn't that be on the internet? You know, if you have a streaming video service, yes, it requires a lot of capacity, maybe a lot of buffering, things like that. But today you can get high-definition video on YouTube, on Netflix, in different places where they're using standard internet connections. I think they think there could be money to be made there. We would, I think, fear that the money to be made there is not only because of the advances and the innovations, but because of the choking down and the dampening down of other alternatives. So maybe the HD opera channel becomes a lot more attractive if you can't get regular opera at anything close to high definition, or if, you know, any sort of music or entertainment package. What we worry about most with the specialized services category, I think it's fair to say, is that not only will it be prioritized, but that the public internet, the best efforts internet, as people sometimes refer to it, will be stripped bare, and that'll become a second best and a distant second best option for people on both ends, both for consumers and for new innovators, people who can't afford to pay to get their content or their website on those faster lanes.
Yeah, so we're truly going. This goes beyond fast and slow lanes. It goes to the the issue that if there is an A internet and a B internet, and that one is the premium and one you have to pay to access and the other is open and free, is that there might be some content that at one point would have been open to everybody, and those people would say, well, we're moving to the A internet, and unless you're on the A internet, you're not going to get it at all because it's not going to be on the B internet, and it won't be there on the B internet.
Right, or only a watered-down version will be there or yeah. something like that. I mean, it's, you know, it's these are not easy comparisons to make, but I'll make them anyway to try and illustrate some of the points. You talk about AM and FM radio. If you look at the difference between those two, mm-hmm. used to be relatively competitive, and then AM sort of became very specialized and became talk only and news only and, you know, music, but usually for niche communities or for smaller communities, not sort of the general popular music, however people want to define that. So you could have that sort of situation where you have the A internet and the B internet, as you so rightly put it, serving very different audiences, and we have great fears about that from a democratizing and innovation standpoint as well, because we think that lower, slower lane would be certainly available for people to get onto, but there might not be that many eyeballs there looking at it. People might be, you know, either forced into or greatly incentivized into the faster lane where you get more corporate content, more popular websites, and new ones can't bubble up the way that they have. You look at something like Twitter or Facebook or YouTube, and these are all things that a decade ago were not there. Literally just, you know, dreams that people were having in their garage. And it sounds kind of hokey in a way to say that we're trying to protect the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Twitter. But, you know, those companies are out there, and they won't necessarily have the same chances to reach the millions of people that today's Internet giants have gotten to reach because of the open nature and the open architecture of the Internet.
Mm. Just one sort of, maybe this is a fine point, I guess that there are some people who would make the argument that already there is now a huge gap in the resources among content providers. Some of them are giants, and they have huge resources. Some of them are much, much smaller. And so that almost makes the idea of net neutrality kind of moot. Do you see a point in
well,
that?
Well, I wouldn't say moot. There are people who like to say that, well, Google has a lot of money too, and they can do things to move their content to you faster by making their own private network arrangements on the side, doing something that's called caching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Internet is a great technology and basically moves at the speed of light or the speed of sound, depending on which kind of technology you're using, somewhere very quickly in there. But it does matter how close a server is to you when you call something up. So you can get a faster delivery if something is located closer to you, and it can move to you more quickly when it's taking fewer hops across the Internet. So larger companies can take advantage of such things, and they do. We just don't think that the Federal Communications Commission has to step in there to regulate that area for a couple different reasons. It's not something historically that the FCC has done. It's not something that we want them to do, to be in the business of managing content on two-way communications networks like telephone systems or the Internet. And it truly is competitive in a way that network operator businesses are not. You know, as large and dominant as Google is, you have Bing able to compete with them, and obviously Bing is another search engine from another giant. It's from Microsoft. But the switching cost, as we say sometimes for consumers, if you want to switch from one to the other, is simply typing a few keystrokes and jumping to the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You could go to some lesser-known search engine, too, that, you know, may work even better. We're not sure where that might be coming from now, but it could be out there. So the big companies do have definite advantages they can use, but they can't choke off or control consumer access the same way that somebody who is running the only wire into your home can. Because, you know, with all the advantages they might have, we're not saying that innovation and technology shouldn't be allowed for companies to take advantage of that themselves and to make their services better. We just don't want that at the center and in the network where the operator can kind of control everything running to one person's home or one person's handheld device.
Our guest in this hour, Matthew Wood. He is Associate Director of the Media Access Project in Washington. It's a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization that works in communications policy. And among the various issues that they have been interested in over time, this thing that we're talking about here this morning, open access and network neutrality. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email wilt-talk@illinois.edu. You know, the last time that we talked about this on the program was back in May, and the reason for wanting to have that conversation was to talk a little bit about a court ruling that came down in early April. This was the case of Comcast v. FCC. And in this, in my sort of limited understanding, and you can talk some more about this, essentially what the court said was that the FCC had authority over communication services. So I guess that we're talking about the telephone, for example, but not information services, which would cover the Internet, and which it says broadband is. And that according to the last rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. So the broadband providers, essentially, they were making the argument that the FCC has no authority to regulate them at all, according to their own rules. So then the question was, well, okay, how exactly does all of this get worked out? And I think it's at the FCC, they're still trying to figure out, well, what exactly does this mean? Can they, and how do they make the argument that they do in fact have the authority to regulate broadband? Mm-hmm. Where does this stand now?
Well, it stands basically where it was back in May, and I'll be happy to go into the current events. The Google-Verizon deal is part of the current events picture, and it sort of colors what's been going on here in D.C. or helps to explain and illustrate some of what's been going on. Mm-hmm. Just to poke at the edges a little bit of your summary, which is 95 or 99% of the way there, but a couple additional details I think are important if we're going to get down to this level.
Sure.
For one thing, it's called telecommunications in the Communications Act, not just communication services. Uh-huh. So a telecommunication service is something like a telephone. Completely meaningless distinction. All means the same thing to you and me as we speak English here on the radio. But in the court and at the FCC, the word telecommunications is kind of a magic word that has a special meaning, and it fits within a certain part of the Communications Act, which is the statute that governs the FCC and determines what they can do and how they can do it. The information services distinction, that's exactly right, and that is where broadband has been placed, not by this court, though, in this decision, and not by any court, actually, but by the FCC itself. Back in 2002, the FCC first made a decision on this question by placing cable broadband services, or what is commonly called cable modem service, into that category, saying that it is not a telecommunications service, it's an information service. And the reasons for that were many and varied. We don't really agree. My organization, among others, 8 years ago, were fighting against that very decision, so we at least have a consistent track record on this. And we're looking to undo that now in the current FCC proceeding. But one of the main reasons for that is that the commission at that time determined that the information component of your broadband service is inextricably intertwined with the telecommunications component. And what that means is that when a broadband provider like Comcast or Verizon or AT&T or a smaller phone company or cable company that both controls the wires and provides you with your Internet access service is providing you that bundle of services, that the transmission of information is somehow intertwined with the programs that ride on top of it, with your email access, with your web surfing, with whatever you use your internet connection for. So that is a tricky technical question. That's something the FCC decided, though, and something we think they decided incorrectly back in 2002, and then subsequently again in 2005 and 2006 and 2007 as they extended that kind of reasoning to other technological platforms, not just cable, but also broadband as provided by phone companies and as provided by wireless companies. So this court didn't make that decision, and in fact, the Supreme Court didn't make that decision, but I think Professor Amore last time was talking about how the Supreme Court had sanctioned that decision, mm-hmm. not unanimously, not mm-hmm. by looking at the merits of it and saying, yes, FCC, you have chosen the only right way to go here, that broadband is obviously an information service, but basically, as courts often do, looking at an agency decision saying, this is a reasonable interpretation of your statute, and if it's reasonable, we'll give you some deference there. You are the expert agency, and you're allowed to interpret your statute within bounds in a way that fits that statute, and that's a reasonable interpretation of it. So that is where the proceeding stood back in May. In an effort to reassert some sort of FCC authority over broadband, and again, not over the content on the Internet, but over the broadband transmission component itself, the Commission was considering undoing certain key aspects of those Bush-era FCC decisions that declassified and deregulated broadband and placed it into this other information services category. That has been kind of frozen in place. There have been comments filed on it. That's something where the public and organizations like mine and large companies, everybody really, individual citizens, can file their written thoughts with the FCC and say, you should or you shouldn't do this. Happens with all sorts of rulemaking, some of which are very popular now because you have organizations like Free Press or you have the companies themselves alerting people to the fact that these proceedings exist so they can get tens or even hundreds of thousands of comments sometimes from the public on these questions. The FCC had the two rounds of comments that they needed to have on that proceeding on whether or not to undo this, what we call a mistake, but you know what was certainly a deregulatory move back in the middle of the decade. And that's where we sit now. The Commission doesn't always move at a glacial pace, but occasionally they do. They have no obligation to complete that rulemaking that they started, or really it was what's called a notice of inquiry, if we're going to be very technical. And it's still sitting there now. There's some question about what they'll do next, if Congress will try to act in the meantime, or if the commission will ever complete this rulemaking on its own. What they spent a lot of their summer doing, rather than making a decision on this public process, was convening meetings between various stakeholders. And so six different parties were in the room at the FCC with the chairman's chief of staff, so definitely with the blessing of the FCC as they were talking about this and trying to hammer out some sort of compromise on these net neutrality principles. It was interest from the cable industry, from their trade association that represents all of the cable companies here in D.C., Verizon and AT&T on behalf of the large landline and wireless telephone carriers that they are. And then some organizations on the other side, Google was in the room, Skype was in the room, the popular voice over IP calling company. And then something called the Open Internet Coalition, which in full disclosure, I should tell you, my organization is part of that Open Internet Coalition, or OIC, as we call it, as are many others. But it wasn't something where, you know, there was sort of a vote being taken amongst the members. One of the people who is a leader of the OIC and a lawyer who works on these issues was in that room. Those talks eventually broke down, and the very next week we got the public announcement of the Google-Verizon deal, which had been rumored for quite some time. So that's really where the commission has spent a lot of time this summer, is in talking about how to hammer out a compromise. And the problem that we see with that is that we think the commission should just go ahead and complete this proceeding they instituted back in May when you were last talking about this issue, and that there really is no compromise to be had here, as the Google-Verizon proposal shows that there are certain things that the network operators simply aren't going to give up on. There are certain things that we, as the net neutrality proponents, think we simply can't give up on behalf of the public, and that we're not going to reach any sort of consensus on these issues anytime in the near term.
Yeah. Well, that just, again, to then that's good. That puts the Google-Verizon thing in some sort of context, because what you're suggesting is that as they thought they were offering this as something of a compromise, where they were saying, okay, as far as wired connections go, net neutrality is good. Let's have some rules there. But the issue was that it leaves wide open the area where we expect there is going to be the greatest growth, and that is by people using various kinds of wireless devices like smartphones and iPads and other touch slates and, you know, whatever kind of thing that it is, that's going to use a wireless connection to get the content. They were saying, well, that should be just wide open. We shouldn't have the enforcement of net neutrality there.
Right. And again, I mean, like I said earlier, I don't want to guess too much about people's motivations, but these are easy to guess at. You know, that's something that Verizon was willing to compromise on when it came to their wired service, because they are not throughout the country, but at least on the East Coast and I think parts of the West Coast and in sort of the more populous edges of the country, more densely populated areas, they have the Fios system, which is a fiber optic system, which has a very high capacity, even down to the individual home level. So they have fewer problems with their business model simply saying, sure, we'll let anything that you want flow through those pipes. It's much higher capacity than AT&T, for example, which did not invest. Similar company, very large traditional phone company that now provides wireless services and also broadband services, of course, on wired connections. Mm-hmm. AT&T did not do what Verizon did. They did not make such a large bet on new technology, and at least in most instances are still delivering broadband and even now video service through something they call U-verse, over the same copper wires that were used traditionally to provide phone service. So what is a compromise that Verizon is willing to accept, and to accept some sort of net neutrality principles, non-discrimination and openness principles on the wired internet, is probably something AT&T would not have agreed to. The cable companies, just to complicate things even further, traditionally do not have a large wireless presence. Now that's changing. They have obtained some spectrum licenses over the last 5 years or so, and certain cable companies do have a wireless presence in the markets they serve, but typically speaking, they have not as much concern about wireless. So the cable companies, I think it's fair to say, typically speaking at least, stereotypically, don't really care much about the wireless piece at all. They're happy to, if anything, they might like to have it in so that the wireless competitors they face don't have an advantage over them, and there isn't an unregulated wireless pipe and a regulated wireline pipe into people's homes. So the fact that Google and Verizon made this attempt, you can't blame them. They're trying to do something positive here, but they can't really please anybody on any side of the debate, either the network operators who have different networks and different architectures from what Verizon has, or the companies who aren't quite as well-placed as Google might be to take advantage of new arrangements or to live with these exemptions, with wireless being exempted, if that indeed did become the law of the land. Hmm.
So just, and to go back to the what's happening here with the FCC, for those people who think that net neutrality is really important, I can imagine them saying, now, do you mean to tell me that all the FCC would have to do is sit down and rewrite their rules, authority which they have, and scratch out the part that says, we're not going to regulate broadband, and then write in, yes, we are going to regulate broadband. Is it really as straightforward as that?
Well, in some ways. I mean, anything the FCC does, for better or for worse, is going to be challenged in court. And when we talk about this issue of restoring regulatory oversight authority for broadband, it's something, because net neutrality has become a polarized and politicized issue, kind of strangely, if you ask me, but I guess that's the way everything is right now, more or less, in this country. Net neutrality has become something of a partisan issue where you basically have most Democrats on one side and most Republicans on the other. It's not always the case. As I said earlier, organizations like the Christian Coalition and Parents Television Council and gun owners organizations have been also in favor of net neutrality over the last 5 years at different times. Those who fear the kind of thing you were talking about earlier, the network operators deciding which ideas and which messages can flow over their systems. So it's not always the case, but it has become sort of a partisan issue. Other broadband-oriented issues are not quite that way. We see the reclassification debate, as it's called, this question of how to classify broadband service and where to place it within the FCC's jurisdiction or outside of it, as something that affects many other issues, things you were talking about with Professor Amore, like universal deployment of broadband services at affordable rates, things like public safety initiatives and privacy issues, privacy protections for consumers when they're using broadband services. Because net neutrality is more of a hot-button issue, a lot of the people opposing net neutrality and opposing this reclassification measure are one and the same, and they've really tried to conflate the two issues. So this reclassification question is larger than simply the net neutrality question. And what that means is that even if the FCC did go ahead, as you just suggested, and just kind of take the votes they have, really they do have the votes right now to do this. It's just a five-person commission. Two commissioners pretty strongly opposed to the reclassification attempt, two very much in favor. The chairman deciding which way is the best route to go in the middle. But if it came to a vote, would almost certainly vote for reclassification. It's just that he and his team have not been willing to put that up to a vote yet, as they've sought a less contentious and less political way to come to compromise here. And that's why they've spent their whole summer talking to the parties, either behind closed doors or in smaller groups, and not moving the public process along. So it is almost as simple as you said. There would be a court case. In our mind, you know, the next court case would be relatively definitive, whereas if the FCC continues down the path it was on prior to the April decision you mentioned earlier, where everything was kind of thrown into disarray, they could continue to pursue, let's call them more inventive legal theories as to how to have some oversight authority, but not too much over broadband, over net neutrality, but all the other issues that I mentioned as well. And if that's the case, then we're not going to have one lawsuit to end all lawsuits or to move things ahead. We'll probably have a lawsuit each and every time the FCC tries to do anything that touches broadband over which they don't have crystal clear authority based on some other part of the statute.
Yeah. Just to underscore a point, Congress, if it so chose, could give the FCC authority over broadband?
Sure. I mean, that's something that we would also say is in the long-term best interests of the country and of Congress to look at this in a more comprehensive way. The point where we disagree with the large network providers, network operators, is whether or not the FCC has the authority today to do this. And we think it's a relatively simple question. They do, too. They just happen to disagree with us and think that the FCC shouldn't be able to undo what it did back in the middle of the decade. You know, to us, it's not a one-way ratchet. That the FCC legitimately could deregulate broadband and place it into this information services category, it's hard to see why they couldn't go the other way and place it into the telecommunication services category and treat it like other two-way communications networks like telephones. Not with all the same rules, but with many of the same protections and the basic non-discrimination protections that we have benefited from, I would say, unquestionably, when it came to telephone service and to keeping that a free and open exchange of information of the consumers and end users choosing. So I think Professor Amore went into this last time. I don't want to get too much into it unless people want to explore it further, but the FCC made that decision to deregulate back in 2002. In 2005, a majority of the Supreme Court said, okay, that's your decision, FCC. You know, we can live with it. It's within reason. The dissent was actually led by Justice Scalia, and I said before that this has become a politicized issue, but it's not always that easy and that simple. Justice Scalia, obviously a very conservative, strict constructionist jurisprudence when he is classified as either-or. He's obviously going to be pushed to the right side of the spectrum, but he really saw through what the FCC was doing in his mind and said, this is ridiculous. This is clearly a telecommunications service, and you know, you can't really play the games that you're playing here to try and take it out of that category. So the majority of the Supreme Court has basically said the FCC can, if it wants to, kind of flip the switch and go back to the other regulatory classification. Obviously, they have to have a reason for doing that. They're required to make a reasoned decision and to do so on the basis of new facts or simply new analysis of what the underlying legal and factual landscape is. But if they put together such an order, it's not as if that has to reach some sort of higher bar. They basically have to just satisfy the same standard they always must satisfy, which is making a decision on the basis of the record in front of them.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Matthew Wood. He's the Associate Director of the Media Access Project in Washington. It's a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy organization that works in communications policy. And we're talking here this morning about net neutrality. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that there are some people who look at all this and make the argument that says that if we're really concerned about net neutrality, well, certainly, and open access, that regulating net neutrality isn't really the answer. They say the answer is more competition, and they point to Europe as a model, because apparently in Europe, people have a lot more choice for their internet service provider. The problem we have here in this country is that there are a lot of people who basically have just two choices. They got the phone company, they got the cable company. That's it. And that certainly the anticipation was at one point that there would be lots of ISPs in this country. Well, there aren't. And they're essentially the ISPs are and the carriers are one and the same. So that's why we got this problem. Is there something that do you think could be, is it reasonable to argue that competition would take care of this problem that we're talking about? And is there some, would there be actually some way to promote that competition?
The first one I think is yes, to a great degree. The second one is a tougher question. Yes, competition could solve some of these problems if we had a truer competition. I mentioned before the idea of switching costs, which is an economic term that I shouldn't throw around as a lawyer because I'm no expert, but we work on these things. And, you know, as I said, if you want to switch from Google to Bing, well, the cost to you is really nothing more than a few seconds and a few keystrokes. If there was a way to switch amongst Internet service providers, as there was in the dial-up world, you know, that was a much slower technology, of course, and today looks like child's play or like a century ago rather than just a decade ago. But it really was quite innovative for its time, and that's where the Internet grew and became a residential and consumer-focused service in the first place. There you could switch amongst different Internet service providers because they were all riding over that same line, coming to you on the phone line, but you know, they were not the phone company themselves. They didn't control both the line and the service they were providing you in the form of access to the Internet or email, web surfing, what have you. So more competition could solve away these problems. I would be a little bit leery of having, you know, instead of two options, saying, well, now we have four, and therefore there's no problem anymore. Or, again, if the person providing you internet service is also the same one who owns the wires into your home, well, then the switching costs become a little bit higher or a lot higher in most circumstances. Competition certainly could help. This is also part of the deregulatory nature of the last, I guess I'd probably say 30 years, but especially the last 10 years. The FCC and Congress in the middle of the 90s did take many steps in a rewrite of the Communications Act to promote this kind of competition that you're talking about. Whether it's what we call facilities-based, which means you build out your own wires, or if you're able to lease them from somebody else and provide a service that way. A lot of those regulatory protections and promotions of competition went by the wayside as well as they were challenged in court. As I said earlier, basically everything that any regulatory agency does, including the FCC, is going to be challenged. And that's not always a bad thing because it helps them to sharpen their focus and their reasoning, but it also means that sometimes it's hard to make and then preserve advances or to preserve what we see as pro-competition policies in this respect. And a lot of those competitive facilitation devices that the FCC had in place from the mid-90s rewrite of the communications law in this country also were shot down at the turn of the century and in the last 5 years. So that second question about how to promote more competition is, I think, a little bit harder. It's something that, again, is quite political, something that the people opposing reclassification now and opposing net neutrality are also opposed to as well, the large telephone and cable company interests. So it's not as if it would be a different battle or an easier route. It would probably, if anything, have some of the same problems and yet take longer to come to fruition because of the economic and physical barriers to deploying new networks in a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we know, and we touched on this, one of the things that we know is that it seems that more and more we should expect that people will be accessing the Internet with portable wireless devices. So either we'll be talking about touch slates like the iPad, or we'll be talking about smartphones or something like that. And so what that means is that the system that was developed for voice transmission is now increasingly being used for data transmission, placing a much greater burden on the system because it requires more a bigger pipe, essentially, mm-hmm. And we have more people accessing it. And so some people are making this argument that says, well, the kind of thing that Google and Verizon have talked about, that's only going to be the start. And, in fact, we're going to have to do this because with more and more people using the Internet and doing it with wireless devices like smartphones and iPads, it's strained the system so much that we've somehow got to build out that system. The money from that's got to come from someplace, and it would be reasonable to expect that it should come from consumers if we can entice them to pay more money for an enhanced service, and then maybe also for content providers who are making money out of providing content. Well, shouldn't they also have to pay something mm-hmm. to the service providers for the privilege of having the content passed along? I mean, isn't this just something that's, we may not like it, but this is where we're going?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if that were the only way to do it, then there might be an argument there. I think you look at something like the iPhone and how successful it's been, and what that has led to, not all the time, but at least on some occasions when they let their guard down, is AT&T more or less blaming their subscribers for the congestion problems, kind of, you know, saying, well, we gave you this great device, and we didn't know you'd want to use it, so we're sorry that it's not working very well. But it's your fault for using it too much. Usually, not to oversimplify things, and again, as I said before, I'm no economist, but supply and demand, the more demand there is, the more supply you should be able to build. And so simply by building up to meet that demand in the way that people always have constructed two-way communications networks in this country, like the phone system, like dial-up internet, like broadband, really, even though there's been no enforceable net neutrality law on the books, that has been more or less the agreed-upon way of doing business, and there have been very few violations of it documented. But, you know, we see now, as I quoted Mark Cooper earlier, the Consumer Federation advocate here in Washington, you know, now we see what companies might try to do further down the line. Historically, the way to meet more demand has been to build more supply on a neutral, best-efforts internet basis, and so that doesn't seem like it's, you know, changing just because of the technology. Yes, there's more data going through the network, but network technologies are getting better as well. People go and buy cell phones, mobile phones, and you know you see these odd acronyms and different things appended to the end of the names. But 2G, 3G, 4G, you see these terms kind of floating out there in consumer parlance as well. But they do have technical meanings or somewhat technical as well. The 2G system is what you were talking about earlier, the phone system, the wireless network that was used to communicate and to send voice messages across the spectrum. When you talk about something like, there was an interim step called 2.5G, and it means a lot of different technologies, but it's just kind of shorthand for technologies that were able to carry some data in addition to that voice traffic. 3G networks are things that we're using now with our iPhones, Droids, other smartphones from Sprint and T-Mobile, and you know, those are called 3G because it means third generation wireless networks that are able to do not just voice but also data in relatively high capacities. And then, you know, just to keep the alphabet soup going, we're coming up to 4G mm-hmm. as AT&T, Verizon, Sprint actually is out in front on this. They and Clearwire are operating what is touted as and what is a fourth generation network that has higher capacities. And so the technology has been able to keep up thus far. There always have been predictions that, you know, 5 years from now, we're just going to be flooded with data, and so therefore we can't possibly let through everything anymore. We need to prioritize it. But you know, when it, as I said in the past, we've just built more capacity, and so far the whole thing hasn't come crashing down. AT&T's CEO, I believe he was Ed Whitaker, 5 years ago talked about this, the notion you were talking about a minute ago. Shouldn't Google be paying something extra to get their content to people? Well, of course, the large companies do pay millions or potentially even billions of dollars in network fees every year because they have to pay for their connectivity. What we're talking about is not setting up an additional toll that says, okay, because you are Google or because you are ESPN or because you're the Republican Party or whomever you might be, we're going to charge you extra and we're going to look inside the envelope, as it were, not just at how much data is coming through our pipe, but also to whom it's addressed and where it's coming from and charge you extra based on that.
And I suppose that is the issue of security is significant, although I suppose also one of the arguments that people make about the so-called premium services or the Tier A internet or whatever it is, that would actually make it possible for there to be greater security.
Yeah, there could be greater security. It's hard to make these decisions for people, and I'm not an engineer, just like I'm not an economist, but there are legitimate uses of the technology that is used to prioritize things. It's usually referred to as DPI, or deep packet inspection technology. Kind of, as I said a minute ago, it's really a pretty good analogy to the way the networks work. You're kind of looking inside the envelope and looking inside the message header to see not just where a bit is going to, not just looking at its address, but also looking at the content. And so that can be used, and in fact is used, by governments to sniff out illegal content. The point that we like to make on that is that's something that we all in our country, you know, not everybody is in favor of this. Some people think we should do more, some think we should do less, but that's something that is a government role. We don't really want the phone companies and the cable companies stepping up and sort of taking matters into their own hands and deciding how much more of that to do. So net neutrality proponents aren't talking about changing existing law when it comes to privacy protections or compliance with law enforcement requests. We just want that to be a separate question and not something that is essentially handed off and handed down to the network operators themselves.
And just real quick, because you know the Obama administration has made a big point of saying they think that for people having access, broadband access is really important. Is it possible that government's going to be more involved in, at the very least, trying to build out the infrastructure to make that possible?
Well, it's possible, and they have been. In fact, the stimulus package, which has been roundly criticized or roundly applauded, depending on where you go, did include a small portion of it for broadband. I say small portion advisedly because it was something like $7 billion. But, you know, that's roughly, what, 1% of what the overall stimulus package was. And it's a little bit less than what is currently devoted each year by the federal government to telecommunications, meaning traditional telephone service, but also some Internet service. The government is now spending anywhere between $8 and $9 billion a year on different subsidies that both go to phone companies and also to low-income and hard-to-reach consumers themselves. So there is a possibility for more. It's just that in this belt-tightening environment in which we've been living, there isn't a lot of extra money floating around out there, and so the prospects for the government doing more, some people on my side might think that they should. Others might disagree vociferously with that, but the prospects for it are pretty grim at the moment because of the budget situation we have more broadly.
Well, there, we'll have to leave it. We're here at the end of the time. I'm sure it's a subject we'll come back to again in the future. But for the moment, want to say thanks to our guest, Matthew Wood. He is Associate Director of the Media Access Project in Washington. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.